Good evening. I'm glad to see each of you here. As he said, I'm Noreen. Come on in, find a chair wherever you can. We're here, both Bill and I are here because we're here to look forward to celebrating next month our 10th anniversary of being here in Ann Arbor as Fair Trade Store, carrying handicrafts, coffee, and chocolate. If you've been in the store, you know of those items. How many of you have been in the store? Good. All right. So some of you know, or most of you know, that we are at 303 South Main Street in just about two blocks over from here. And so if you haven't been in, do come in. For those of you who have, you will note that when you walk in, the store is a little different than many retail stores in that we have volunteers who will greet you, volunteers who will help you shop and will tell you stories, and you will find the product is unique. Now, let's back up, because we need to back up over 10 years ago. In about 2001, a group of local people, mostly from the Shalom community, Mennonite and Church of the Brethren congregation, said, it's time to have a 10,000 Villages store here in Ann Arbor. But we can't do it alone. So many of these people knew the product from stores in other areas and some sales earlier, even as far back as 60 years ago or over 60 years ago now. So why should we do this here in Ann Arbor? And a few people ask that question, but those from Ann Arbor know the answers to that. Well, the beautiful handicraft items would be of value to people in this community, a community that's actually very cultured, involved in the larger international world. So that was one of the values. The other is that the artisans of these handicrafts receive a living wage, a business practice called fair trade. Bill's going to talk about that some more later, which would be of value to this community as well. Okay, so let's just stop right there with a little bit of the history and look at just one of the products. Yes, this fuzzy little guy that some of you saw up here. This is a vicuña. Yes, it's relation to the alpaca and what's the other one? Llama, thank you. Maria from Peru made this, and it says on the tag, among other things, handcrafted in Peru. Doesn't tell you Maria's name. But it is from Maria. Now, Maria was someone who lived up in the mountains, in the high mountains in Peru. Can everybody hear me okay? Can you hear okay? Okay, good, thank you. She lived in the high mountains, but there was a time when her husband and all of the male relatives were killed by the Shining Path. This was a bloody leftist movement to control the government. And when that went through in the 1980s, I believe it was. So she had to leave to make a way for her children to survive. She went down to the dusty city of Lima, the big, huge city. If you've been to Lima, you know that there are very beautiful parts of Lima and there are very, very, very poor parts of Lima where people are living up on the side of the mountain in cardboard huts. And she was probably living in that kind of a facility. She was riding on the outside of the bus. You don't pay when you ride on the outside of the bus. She was hanging on to the outside of the bus and she was going by a lady who was selling these little vicuñas along the highway. And she kept seeing these and kind of kept rolling around in her mind. So she stopped and she asked the lady, will you show me how to make these? The lady said no. And Maria persisted. She would come back time after time. Will you tell me how to make these? No, the lady kept saying. Finally, the lady was tired of the pestering. And so she said, okay, I will show you how to make these vicuñas. But she said, I never want to see you again. In other words, what the lady was saying was, I never want to see you selling in my district, so go somewhere else then. Well, Maria, along with her now grown children, has developed her successful business, making these vicuñas and other products for sale with the help of 10,000 Villages Fair Trade Organization. She was able to feed and educate her children, some of whom are working in the business and along with grandchildren as well now. So one success story, that's only one. Each of the products in our store represents a story of an artisan. Could be a man, could be a woman, more likely a woman, who is finding her way in the world to feed her family and take care of her family. So now with that, I'm going to go back. That's why we wanted the store here in Ann Arbor. We wanted to be able to get these stories out, to see the beautiful product. So there was much enthusiasm and work that went into those early days before the store actually opened. There were off-site sales that were held in churches, temples, community centers, markets, Pfizer and other offices, and I might have left out something, but many different sales and presentations. There was planning, unpacking product, temporary display, selling, telling the story, packing up and storing. These all took special care and, not to negate, muscle, a brain, and brawn that it took to haul these things and to present them to people. Well, why put forth all that energy? Well, I've already told you one story that tells you why it was worthwhile. The community needed to see the product and hear the stories of the artisans. Each item in the store is handmade by a person with his or her story. Thousands of dollars were needed to open a store, a storefront. We needed to have money from a product that we sold as well as donations in order to raise the monies that were needed to have a good place and a place that people would enjoy coming to and purchasing our product. Finally came the fruits of our labor. After the local startup board celebrated by getting their Michigan tax-exempt 501c3 status, the process was in full gear. We identified Main Street as the location that it had to be on. But when we found the right place, we could not get in until extensive renovation was done to the whole building. For some of you, you might remember the old Lucky Drugs. That's the building we're in now. This was renovated not only on our level, but the whole building was renovated. So that took some extra time, and construction was delayed a bit. But meanwhile, through the sales and presentations to organizations, recruitment of friends and other like-minded people, we continued to grow. There were even those who regularly pressed their noses against the window to see, when are you going to open? And would ask us as we walked out the door, when will you open? Well, we tried not to miss the opportunities to say, well, when we do open, would you like to volunteer? So finally, in October of 2004, after teams of volunteers were trained, manager hired, shelving units built and painted to display the inventory, carpet was chosen and laid, painting and electrical work done, a very excited and a bit nervous staff opened the doors of the store to the public on a fine fall day. In came well-wishers, the curious, and the shoppers. Still today, we are very thankful for the ongoing support of the people of Ann Arbor and surrounding communities as they purchase our product and tell our story. As I say many times a day to customers as I volunteer in the store, this store is here to support the artisans that are represented by their handicrafts. You will find products from over 30 different countries, Asia, Africa, and South and Central America. On the price tag, you'll find where the country of origin is listed. Also, I say, using a common phrase for a unique store, it's a win-win situation for all. We get the lovely product, and the artisans get a much better way of life through fair trade. And before you leave, I encourage you to enjoy the items from Africa. I brought just a few that are back here, and there is a screen that will loop a presentation about the artisans who make some of these items. So before you leave tonight, you might want to watch that. I know a few of you got a chance to see that earlier. Well, day-to-day management of any retail store or any store means you've got to be ready to open and close at the listed time. So you need to have a number of things to be organized for that. We get our product through our headquarters, 10,000 Villages headquarters in Pennsylvania. We're managed and owned by a local board of directors here in the Ann Arbor and surrounding area. There's a full-time paid manager, and that's Bill Henderson, who's going to talk to you soon, and several assistants. But there's other things to be done. The carpets need to be swept each day, dusting done, restrooms cleaned, unpacking of new merchandise, and customers being taken care of. That all is done by the volunteers. We have about 80 people at present working in the various shifts. Some people work once a week. Some of us add a shift as needed, and still others choose a shift when it best works in their lives. I will say that not all volunteers are like Bill and I, white-haired. All ages are volunteering. We have high school students. We have a few university students, graduate students, wives of students who are here from other countries who are volunteering, as well as retired teachers and all in between. So with that, I'm going to stop. And if you have any questions, I'd love to answer those right now. If there's something about something I've said or something that you've experienced when you've been in the store, I'd like for you to ask a question. Just raise your hand and I will bring the microphone around to you.
How many other stores are there and what cities are they in and how do they compare?
Yes, sure. We do have a brochure tonight that we'll hand out. Be sure to get that because it lists all the stores in the U.S. that are a 10,000 Villages store. Bill can speak more to that also. And you ask how many?
There are about 80 branded stores. When I call branded, these would be stores that would say 10,000 Villages over the door. And they're about equally divided between stores that are structured such as ours, which is called technically a contract store with 10,000 Villages. And what that means is that we have a contract with 10,000 Villages in order to use their name. We agree that we will sell the majority of our product from their warehouse. You want me over there? And they in turn provide us technical support, access to their warehouse inventories so we can do special orders for customers. There are about 300 other what they call alliance stores. These are stores that are fair trade retail stores that purchase product from our warehouse but don't call themselves 10,000 Villages. And the example I use is in Indianapolis, there's a group of five stores called Global Market. They have five stores. They're a huge account with us, but they carry an awful lot of clothing, and clothing is not one of the product items that are included in 10,000 Villages product mix. So because they sell such a large proportion of their sales in clothing, they wouldn't qualify to be called a 10,000 Villages store. But the gift sections of their stores is mostly 10,000 Villages product. And anytime one of those stores sells a product from our warehouse, it also completes our mission.
Another store that you might be familiar with is over at Holland, Michigan, a store called The Bridge. And that one is one that a number of people know about, too, that is fair trade. Everything they carry is fair trade. They just don't have the name because of what Bill was saying. Any other questions? Right now.
Yes. Can I just give this to you? We're recording this. That's why we need your...
Are you wearing stuff from 10,000 Villages?
Well, I happen to be, yes. Yes, my necklace, which is made of wood and horn, bracelet horn, and two of them are chagua nut, which is a nut that comes from a palm tree, and usually South America is where we get Ecuador and other countries in South America. This is a beaded bracelet that comes from Guatemala. So, yes. Oh, let's see. Yeah. Oh, I forget where these come. They're bone, but are they?
India.
I think they are too, yes. Right. Good question. Okay. All right. Well, then with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill and let him talk with you and be thinking about other questions that you might have. Thank you for your time.
Hi. Well, Noreen has been with us from the beginning. Noreen was part of the startup crew. Noreen sat on the startup board of directors. Noreen and her husband did a lot of the things she discussed, painting and building fixtures and packing and unpacking product to take to offsite sales. So it's much easier to have a storefront where we can show this product to the public without having to pack it up at the end of the night and take it home and put it in someone's basement and the next day bring it out again and show it at the next location. So the startup crew was terrifically important to getting us started. They raised over $100,000 to rent the space, fixture the store, buy the merchandise to inventory the store. Then from that group, we've grown a tremendous group of volunteers. Many of them have been with the store for 7, 8, 9 years working in the store. So it's very gratifying to be the manager of such an enthusiastic crew. In fact, we have Paul and Janet here who've been with the store for 10 years. They volunteer on Wednesday nights. And Paul's our coffee expert. He unpacks our coffee orders that come in every Wednesday. So I'm going to talk briefly about fair trade. And the thing that I think that is so, one of the things I do when I talk to customers in the store, I always explain the fact that we are a nonprofit retail store. We are a nonprofit fair trade retail store. Now, I know that nonprofit and retail really don't go together in most people's minds, but what our mission is to be sure that the artisans who are producing product for our store are getting a fair wage for the product. So we begin the process by negotiating a price that the buyers feel is fair to them, that the sellers feel is fair to them, that the product that we are going to purchase, they're going to be able to meet the standards of fair trade. So I want to tell you what the fair trade standards are. We are a member of the Fair Trade Federation, and the Fair Trade Federation has fair trade principles which all members adhere to. So I'm going to read these up. Creating an opportunity for economic and socially marginalized producers. We do search out artisan groups who are disadvantaged and provide them a market. An example I can give you is in Cambodia, we have an artisan group that makes jewelry for us, and they are using spent bombshell casings to produce earrings and necklaces. Most of the artisans in this workshop are injured in some manner, many of them from spent bombshells. And so in Cambodia, if you are not perfectly formed, they don't want to have you viewed by the public. So these individuals wouldn't be allowed to become waiters or busboys or porters or anything where they're going to be viewed in the public view. So this gives them an enclosed workshop where they can earn an income, support their families, and it's just amazing that the spirit that comes through from the product that they produce, which are ordinances which many of them have been injured from. Second principle, develop a transparent and accountable relationship. And for 10,000 villages, that means that we work with artisan groups on average for 18 to 20 years. One of our charges to our artisan groups is that you'll educate your children. And it just so happens that about 18 or 20 years is about how long it takes to educate your children. And then the children who are now nurses or lawyers or engineers are supporting their parents, and their parents may not have to make the crafts that they were doing previously. Develop and build capacity. We try to work with artisan groups to help them to build capacity in the production that they do. As we've grown, as 10,000 Villages has grown, as we've grown to nearly 400 retail outlets where we distribute our product, it's very difficult for us to go into a community and talk to an artisan group of 8 or 10 individuals and ask them to make 2,500 items for this Christmas. So we are working by building capacity by working with co-ops within the country. So we have co-ops that will find the artisan groups. We will certify the artisan groups are meeting all of our standards, and then they will farm out this production to a variety of artisan groups so that they can meet the demand that we have developed. We promote fair trade. Our mission says that we will sell the artisan's product, tell the artisan's story, and educate about fair trade. This event is one of those events that helps us educate about fair trade. We pay promptly and fairly. And it's interesting what the way 10,000 Villages payment structure has worked. As an artisan, once we've determined a product that we're going to purchase from them and the quantity of which we would like them to produce, we give them half the money in advance before they started production. That eliminates the possibility that they have to go out and borrow to get raw materials. In their markets, often borrowing is a circumstance that they can never extricate themselves from. They never can pay off the debt. Then once the product is complete, the order is ready to ship, it's passed customs, it's been inspected, it's been defumigated, so we don't have any invasive species coming in with our products, we pay the balance. So if the ship sinks on the way to the U.S., the artisans have already been paid, and I always like to say that to customers in the store. Everything that you see in the store, the artisans have already been paid for. So what our mission in the store is to sell it and order more. We want safe working conditions and empower the workers. Noreen alluded to the fact that 70% of the artisans that produce product for our store are women. The majority of the co-ops are run by women. So when we go to a co-op or to an artisan group and we say, one of the things we'd like you to do is educate your children, that's not a hard sell, because that's what every mother wants to do, is get their children educated to give them a better life. We want to ensure the rights of children. We inspect our workshops to make sure that they are not using child labor in any manner. We want them to cultivate an environmental stewardship. And what that means is that we don't want them to pollute their environment to make products for us. In fact, this fall we have a new leather purse that is one of the very first products coming from a new tannery that has a green method of tannery, because tanning leather is very polluting. It pollutes a lot of water. This is certified green tanning of this leather, so it's very exciting to be able to have them. We also receive a tremendous amount of product that is made from recycled material. We have recycled soda cans. We have recycled newspapers made into plates, into napkin holders, into bowls. And then the other one we do is we want them to respect their cultural identity. We're not going to ask the artisans in Pakistan to make Mickey Mouse for us. We want them to make something that reflects their culture and that will be appreciated by the people who are shopping our stores. Now, these same artisans are always asking us, well, what can we make that will sell well in North America? And we will advise them that you make a beautiful basket, but if you could do that in blue and green, we probably will sell more in North America than if you make it in orange and black. A lot of the jewelry, we are helping them pick colors that are trending in the North American market. We're not changing the method of which they produce the product, but we are helping them develop a product that's acceptable to the North American marketplace. But my biggest issue on fair trade is that the focus is on the producer. We want to make sure that the producer is making a fair wage. We are not worried about the investors in our corporation. We are not worried about the next quarter's statement as to whether we were profitable. And we are definitely not trying to drive the price of production down. One of the things I always like to talk about in the store is, if the Americans would pay $2 more for your jeans, workers in Bangladesh wouldn't be locked into factories where they can't leave, and when the factory burns down, they die. So a little history about 10,000 Villages as a corporation. 10,000 Villages started in 1946, and it was started by a woman, her name is Edna Ruth Beiler, and she and her husband were traveling in Puerto Rico. They were working for the Mennonite Central Committee, and they were helping educate farmers on farming practices. And Edna came across some women who were doing beautiful hand embroidery on tablecloths and table linens. And she started talking to these women. They had a small little storefront, and occasionally someone would come in and buy a piece of product. And she kept talking to them where else they sold their product. Well, they took it to the local market, and they were making pennies. And she just thought it was such beautiful stuff. She bought a number of tablecloths and napkins and brought them back to Pennsylvania. And then she was showing them to the women at her church and had a little sale. And, of course, the women in the church started to tell Edna, well, the next time you go, Edna, can you bring me a tablecloth and 12 napkins? And I'd like it in blue and green, or I'd like it in, you know, a different color. And it dawned on her that she could become this direct conduit from the artisan to the eventual consumer in the U.S., eliminating a lot of the middlemen who take up a lot of the money and making sure that the artisans are getting a fair wage. She started out by driving around the country in an old white station wagon. And the story is that she wanted a white station wagon with red interior so people would know she's coming. and doing little sales, you know, Mennonite churches in communities, and stopping and unloading her wares and doing a little sale. In 1951, the Beilers traveled to Jordan and to India, and Edna found artisans there who were doing embroidery, and she bought product and brought it back. So over the years, it became a church basement sale. And then eventually they decided they wanted to add to their mission was to increase the market. So they began to open storefronts. They did it in two methods. They did it as the store in Ann Arbor did, and I think the very first store that opened is in Bluffton, Ohio. And they started out being called self-help craft stores. And the idea was that these were crafts, and these artisans are helping themselves. Well, they found out that a lot of people were coming in, and they wanted to learn how to make crafts. Please help me learn to make crafts so I can help myself. So after they ran those stores for a while, in the mid-90s, early 90s, they decided that they would change the name to 10,000 Villages. And it's an interesting name because it has an interesting story behind it. 10,000 Villages is a quote from Gandhi. And what the quote, roughly paraphrased, says that if you really want to know India, you will not find her in our large cities. You will find her in our 10,000 villages. And that's how you learn the country. So the 10,000 Villages has now been our store name. We are now have a fair trade retailer as our byline underneath the thing. So in 1946, we started. The mission of 10,000 Villages was to develop a market for fairly trade product in North America. We've already talked about this. We have about 80 branded stores across the country. We have about another 300 fair trade retail stores that use our product. And then 10 years ago in Ann Arbor, the Ann Arbor 10,000 Villages of Huron Valley, the store in Ann Arbor, was opened. We are a local business. We are a 501c3 local business. We have a local board of directors. This is often, we were talking to the Think Local First group here in Ann Arbor last summer. They asked us if we would we were nominated for an award during the summer festival, and we submitted all the forms, and someone on the board of directors for that award had decided that, no, well, they're a franchise. You know, they're not a local business. And so we were not considered for the award, and when we had a discussion with the director of the organization and explained how our store is structured, she says, well, you certainly qualify. You have a local board of directors. You're financially responsible for ourselves. So if we fail, no one else is going to come and bail us out. But we do use 10,000 Villages' name because it has some recognition around the country and the technical support that they provide us with our registers and such. We have over 80 volunteers in the store that work to help run the retail store and sit on our board of directors. These volunteers come from all over Southeast Michigan. In fact, right now, we have them as far away as Lansing coming in to sit on the board of directors and to volunteer in the store. We're one of the, we are extremely fortunate to be one of the top selling stores out of the 80 branded stores. We have an extremely supportive community that shops early and often. Christmas is coming, shop early and often. It's been very gratifying. It's, as Noreen said, a win-win situation when we can present a product to somebody that is beautifully made and exactly what they're looking for. And the benefit is we can print you a story about it so you can learn about the artisan group that made it. You can learn about the country that it came from. Because of our success, we've been able to be very generous with our excess or surplus, I guess we would call it, since we're nonprofit. We don't make a profit, but we do make some surplus. We, after we paid our rent and lights and taxes, we have on an annual basis donated back to other community nonprofits around $2,500 a year annually, sometimes more depending on how successful the store is. We also donate back to Artisan Relief Fund, which is centered at the corporate headquarters of 10,000 Villages. For instance, 2 years ago, we did the typhoon relief in the Philippines after the typhoon swept through and devastated many of the communities. And we had artisan groups who were extremely fortunate to be outside of the central part of the destruction of that, but they were also affected. We also had some flooding in Pakistan, and we have artisans who weave rugs for us in Pakistan. And what they like to do is they like to sit on the ground when they're weaving. So they've dug their looms into the ground in their homes. So when the flood came, there was no way for them to get the looms up out of the ground, and the looms were destroyed by the flood. So we went in after the flood, and we helped them reconstruct their homes. And in the process, we constructed chainfall lifts and structure and supports for the chainfalls so that when the flood comes again, which it will, they will be able to raise the looms above the level of the flood and then be able to resume the production much more quickly and get back into an income-producing state. I want to talk a little bit about this particular basket because there's a wonderful story. Our former CEO used to travel the world, and he has a great story about this basket. This is a kaisergrass basket, and it's made out of grasses that grow wild along the sides of railroad tracks, and the women cut them and then wrap them with palm leaves. And he was talking to the woman in this one village, and he came and he saw this little basket, and he was asking her about it, and she was explaining what it was. And he said, "Well, what do you call this basket?" She said, "This is a share." And he goes, "What do you mean this is a share?" And she said, "Well, when we go to market and we're buying sugar or we're buying flour, we can't be sure that the weights and measures that the vendor is selling to us are accurate. So this is a share. If we want to have sugar and we fill this with sugar, this is a fair share that I can pay for, or a fair share for flour." They know how much they're paying for a share of whatever they're purchasing in this size of a basket. This basket was originally brought into our product line in 1987, and we still sell it. We have over 5,000 items in the store, and it lands about 1,200 out of the 500. So it's in the top half of the items we sell this all the time. So the story is that he was asking her, "Can you make one with a flat bottom?" And she was unsure what he was asking her to do because they kept showing different sizes of this basket with this rounded bottom. So he says they dug a hole in the ground and they made it the size of a standard waste basket with a flat bottom and a round sides. And he said, "Can you make a basket that'll fill this hole completely?" "Oh yeah, they could do that." So we have waste baskets made out of this kaisergrass, and we still sell those in our store. So this woman who was doing this had two young children running around, and Doug is talking to her about, you know, talking to the little girl, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" She wanted to be a nurse. 18 years later, he's making the rounds. Doug does a program through 10,000 Villages, what they call learning tours, where they take members from volunteers or staff members from the stores, and they travel to regions of the world where we purchase product, and they visit the artisan groups in those regions of the world. And we do it every year. They take a tour, and he was back 18 years later visiting the same village, and the young girl was finishing off her nursing degree. And he said that just made, you know, it made him feel so good. So it is interesting. In May, we had a visit from a woman from Kenya who was here. She's the director of Namiana. Her name is Kathy Matambo. She's the director of Namiana, and it is a group of Maasai women who do beadwork for us. They make wonderful necklaces. We do keychains and ornaments, all done out of beadwork. And Kathy was here because her younger sister was graduating from the University of Michigan's nursing program. And her sister lives in Ann Arbor, so she came for the graduation, and she brought her parents. And her parents spoke no English, and so they were at the store. She came into the store to introduce herself, and we were talking about, could she please come and do a presentation to my volunteers? They'd love to hear some of your stories from Kenya. So she brought her parents, and they were in full Maasai dress. And she told some wonderful stories about the ability of the... What's happened in Kenya is the Maasai are a herding tribe. They drive their cattle up the Rift Valley following the rain, and they drive them back south as the rain, as the seasons change. Well, Kenya has become a modern agricultural society, and they've fenced in lots of the traditional migration routes that the herdsmen used to use. So there's some difficulty. And also, the tribe is very patriarchal. Women are not allowed to have any property. So if you are a mother of daughters and your husband dies, all of his property goes to a nephew or a brother. The wives and daughters could never inherit. So this Namiana group started selling beads, selling jewelry through 10,000 villages, and they sell it in Europe. They sell it in other fair trade outlets as well, and earning their own income. And what happened is they were able to buy their own truck. They were talking on cell phones. They were able to purchase their own livestock. And so in the video, Kathy is in one of these videos, and she's talking about how they used to have to hire the young men to drive the trucks, but the young men were just too difficult to work with, so that she taught herself how to drive so she didn't have to have the young men because they wouldn't go where she wanted them to. So it was just a wonderful evening to have her there and to show our artisans. And the other story that she told is that in the tradition of the tribe is that the young women are married at a very young age because of the dowry that they bring back to their fathers. So young women at the age of 14 and 15 years old are being married off because the father will receive cattle or livestock as a dowry for his daughter. And she, of course, is telling the mothers, you need to educate your daughters to give them a better opportunity to succeed in life. And she's at the hospital one day, and one of the women from her tribe comes in, and she only speaks Maasai. And the doctors in the hospital speak Swahili, French, and English. So they couldn't communicate with each other. She couldn't tell them what her symptoms were. She didn't understand what they were asking, and they didn't understand what she was trying to tell them. But Kathy happened to be there that day, and of course she spoke English and Maasai, so she was able to interpret for this mother, and they got the treatment, and she got the medicine, and she went back to the village, and she was cured. So then Kathy is talking to the father about marrying off his young daughter, and she said, you know, it might be smart if you educated her, because if you have to go to hospital, and I'm not there to interpret for you, who's going to tell the doctors what's wrong with you? He sent her to school. And of course, the volunteers just, that gives you the warm fuzzy, and everybody just felt, you know. So she's trying to make the point, every time we meet with artisans at workshops or we travel and meet with artisans, they're always so appreciative of the effort. Sometimes standing in the store and selling product to the customers as they come and go, it seems pretty routine to us. And then you hear these stories about how small things like that make such a huge change in our lives. So one of the things we like to talk about is to think globally. There's horrible poverty around the globe. There's starvation and deprived societies. And you can act locally. You can act locally by supporting fair trade, whether it be at 10,000 villages or look for other. There are lots of stores in town that carry product that are fair trade. There's coffee. There's chocolate available at grocery stores. There's other fair trade vendors in Alpena, in Ann Arbor. 10,000 villages happens to be 100% fair trade. We are a member of the Fair Trade Federation, so therefore all the product that we purchase to bring into our store is certified fair trade and members of the Fair Trade Federation. I do have brochures that will show you where other stores in the country are located. We have a tendency to cluster. Our headquarters are in Akron, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Lancaster, and they've grown like an amoeba. So there are many of them in the eastern half of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana. We have a couple in California now, one in Seattle, Denver, Fort Collins, several in Texas. 10,000 Villages of Huron Valley is the only branded 10,000 Villages store in Michigan. But in Chelsea, there's a fair trade store that is an Alliance store and buys from us. The Bridge in Holland, Carabos in East Lansing. So there are a handful of other locations. If you go to the website and you look, if you don't live in Ann Arbor and you put in a zip code, they'll give you the Alliance stores as well as the 10,000 Villages branded stores. Any other questions?
So who decides what is a fair trade? I mean, what is a fair wage?
The artisan. The artisan.
But the artisans might not understand what a fair wage is if you've always been paid poverty wages.
Well, what the negotiation is that we want you to do to educate your children, to provide housing and health care, to be environmentally. And in order to do all these things and make a fair wage on this product, what do you need to make in it? If they really are too cheap, we'll tell them. If they're too expensive, the problem being is by the time we have all of the expenses to get the product to the stores, it can be too expensive on the other end of that equation. We want to be fair both to the producer and to the consumer. If it's too expensive in the store and we don't sell it, that doesn't help the artisan either. So we try to help them understand, but it's basically the artisans are saying, this is how much I need to get for this.
Is there an average amount of money per product that goes back to the, or percentage that goes back to the user?
Well, my answer to that is they're already paid, there's nothing that goes back to them. It's difficult to, because if it's an expensive item, they will get more money back and we will take less at our end because we want to be able to sell it. So, you know, I can't say, oh, it's a 50% that they get, because some of them are getting more than that and some of them are getting less than that, but it's a wage that provides them a fair living.
What kind of people buy your or find your product?
Find our product. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have five buyers that work out of the home office or the corporate offices in Pennsylvania, and they're assigned regions of the world. So there's a buyer for South America, there's a buyer for Central America, Africa, India, Pakistan, South India, then also Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Southeast Asia. They work with artisan groups within those countries, and they go regularly to visit them. We also rely on, since we grew out of a Mennonite missionary structure, we are associated with the Mennonite Central Committee, but we are no longer under their umbrella. We're a separate corporation. But we do use their eyes and ears on the ground to help us find artisan groups that are in need of marketing. And so because of the knowledge that the buyers have within the market, and also because as we've grown and we've begun to develop these co-ops within countries where the co-op will help distribute the work through a variety of artisan groups, they're also going to help point us to artisan groups that need help.
How do you judge quality?
how do we judge quality? Well, they send samples to the warehouse, and the samples then are judged by the marketing staff and so forth at the warehouse. It has to meet all the standards for U.S. production. So, like in our toys, there's no lead. We have to make sure that the beads aren't going to come off in the eyes and so forth. Everything is, as I said, fumigated, both when it leaves country and when it arrives in the U.S. customs, when it passes through customs. So as far as the product that is coming out of our warehouse and into our stores, it's meeting all the U.S. standards. So quality, obviously, is followed by the sample that we've got and then testing the product as it comes through.
Yeah. And something else I wanted to add to that is that we have buyers that also go to the New York, the big markets, to see what's coming, see what colors, see what quality of things are coming out. So we're pretty sophisticated in that way, I think. So it's not just a case of a few people deciding, but it is a bigger way of making a decision. But our buyers do that.
Do you work with artisans in conflict zones? War, post-war areas?
Yeah, yes. Right now we have a couple. We have one of my new favorite product is a necklace from Ethiopia, and it's made out of spent bullet casings that they've silver plated. So yes, we do. We have artisans from the West Bank. We have artisans from India, Pakistan. We have artisans from Africa. I've had a few customers come in and talking about our South American product. We work with the more underdeveloped countries, so we really don't bring a lot in from Brazil and Argentina. We bring it in from Peru, Nicaragua, Ecuador, countries that are less developed. We don't import from Japan or China or Korea, but we import from the Philippines, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Bangladesh.
Will the artisans make the products in bulk, or will they do it one at a time?
They're all handcrafted, so they will on occasion have a bit of an assembly line where one person is doing a portion of it, but it isn't what you would think of as manufactured. It would be, one person is wonderful at carving the base, and the next person, best good example, in Nicaragua we have a product that is a ceramic bowl, and it has a pine needle handles around the top. And there are two different artisan groups that make that. They're on the opposite coasts of the country. So one artisan group makes the ceramic base, and then they ship it across the country, and the other artisan group produces the pine needle handles for them. One of the things when you were talking about purchasing, our supply chain is a bit longer than is probably average for retail stores. From conception, by the time we go back and forth for quality, by the time we go back and forth to make sure the color's right, it's about 18 months that we are working in advance for the product. So the product that's coming in this fall for this Christmas was ordered in the summer of 2012. So that it gets a little difficult in doing some of the forecasting, which what is going to be. We can't be real trendy because we're working too far out. But the other thing that's interesting is back in 2008 and 2009, when the economy got so soft, 10,000 Villages was one of the only fair trade store, fair trade corporations that didn't cancel any orders. A lot of the artisan groups went through a very hard time because when the economy went south in Europe and went south in Asia, the orders that had been placed for product were all canceled. We didn't. We filled up our warehouse, and we went through for a couple years with being a little stale in our product because we had to work through some inventory issues. But that's pretty much taken care of now. We have more trendy stuff than we've had in a few years. We try not to be extremely ethnic, but we just got new giraffes and elephants in. The giraffe's this big.
Do different stores have different
product lines? For instance, does something sell well in Ann Arbor that doesn't sell in other places?
Yes. It's very interesting. One of the things that they do is they give us a ranking on items. So I can look up in the computer any individual item in my store, and I can get a ranking for how well I sell it in my store and how well it sells out of the warehouse. So it's not necessarily specific other stores in the country. And often we will have items that we sell exceptionally well that they don't sell well elsewhere, and vice versa. And I use it often to look at items that are selling well everywhere else, and do I have it displayed incorrectly? What am I doing that we're not selling as much as they are elsewhere? But we have items here. One of our number one selling items in the store is this carved nose, which you rest your glasses on at night. It's about this high. You fold your glasses up and set it on. It's a face. It just sits on the nose. It's $18. It's probably one of the top five items we sell. Yeah. Everybody picks it up, and I said, that's the number one selling.
In the areas that you're working, do the artisans who are not part of your, you're not connected with, are their goods prices affected by what you're doing? Do they go up or down? I mean, do you raise the level of?
Well, it shouldn't. It shouldn't. Hopefully, it does raise the level that they're getting. But because we're taking it out of their local market, there are other fair trade importers. There's a both in Europe and in the United States, and many of them are having very similar product. So they're buying, a lot of them are buying from, because of the co-op nature of things, they're buying a lot of it. So I'm hoping that the answer to that question is yes, but I don't have an empirical evidence that that's the fact.
Do you have any stores out of the US, like in other countries?
There are 10,000 Villages stores in Canada. They are a separate corporation from the 10,000 Villages U.S. We're affiliated in that we'll share, our buyers and their buyers will share product knowledge. But again, there's a financial divide between the two. We're not connected in any financial ways.
What do you do to volunteer at the store? What do you have to do to become one?
Okay, well, I have volunteer applications. What we ask of our volunteers is 8 hours a month. So there's a lot of different things you can do. Obviously, you can be a sales associate on the sales floor, ringing up sales and working with customers and telling stories. That's lots of fun. Everybody has a fun. You can be an inventory crew person that comes in and helps unbox the products as it comes in, check it in so that it's in good condition when we receive it, and you can help with education. We do offsite events. We're always looking for people to go and make presentations to schools, make presentations to service organizations. We do offsite sales where we go to churches. We go up to Brighton. We go around Ann Arbor and do church sales in November and December. The process for becoming a volunteer is to fill out the volunteer application. Then we do an orientation, which gives you basically a big overview of 10,000 Villages. Then you have some worksheets that we work through that to give you one of the training things that we always do is we want our volunteers to be interactive with our customers. We want them to greet our customers. We want them to tell the story. We want them, it's a fine line between hovering and being helpful. But so we go through those, and then you're trained on the register. To be an active, as I said, to be an active volunteer, it's 8 hours a month.
Is there a certain age that you have to be to volunteer?
16.
If there was a product that someone saw in Travels, would it be possible to submit the thought to one of your buyers, or how would someone go about that if they saw something?
Yes. There's, if you went to the website, and it's in this brochure, there is a section where you can say submit an item, and they pretty much walk you right through the process. The likelihood, if it's a country that we're already importing or working with, our buyers are probably already aware of that group. Obviously, the sizes of our stores limits how many items we can put in, but there is a process that helps that. One of the things that I find extremely interesting here in Ann Arbor is that we have lots of Peace Corps volunteers who filter back through the community because of the connections with the Peace Corps. And often they'll come into the store with, I've been in and I've worked with this village and they make the most wonderful, and can I sell it in your store? And how do I get it into the 10,000 villages? So they have developed a process to facilitate that.
Do you carry Native American items?
The only item that we're carrying currently that's manufactured in the U.S. is a, it's a bean soup product that it comes out of Colorado, and it's a fair trade workshop for women who've been rescued from domestic violence, and they make a variety of bean soups, and we sell those through the wintertime.
How often are products delivered to the U.S. from the other countries?
Continuously. We get new products in the store every month from January through November. On average, somewhere between 40 to 60 new items coming into the store monthly. So the flow of product coming into the warehouse is continuous. Basically, it has a lot to do with, we've had delays because of conflicts, we've had delays because of weather, but there's the pipeline. I say the pipeline's 18 months out, so they're constantly moving in. Need one more over here.
If you want something that 10,000 Villages carries, but your store doesn't carry, can you order it from you?
Yes.
So how would you find out about those items?
Well, you can go online. There is a website. 10,000 Villages has an e-commerce component to its marketing. If you've seen it in the store, or if you've seen it somewhere else, and we have a computer in the store that we can search by country, we can search by product category, we can search by price. So we can go, if you came in and said, I saw a friend of this and it's a product she bought from 10,000 Villages and it came from Nicaragua. So I can open up the computer and show you all the products that are in 10,000 Villages inventory from Nicaragua. If we stock it, it'll give me the amount of quantity I have in my store. It'll also give me the quantity that they have in the warehouse. One of my cautions to people who are using online shopping often, which is great, they're completing the mission by buying an item, but when the warehouse inventory drops to a lower level, you know, and they're nervous that if they've got 10 left in the warehouse and they get 12 orders tomorrow, they're going to disappoint two customers, they'll take it off the website until they have adequate stock to make sure that doesn't happen. So often you'll find things in the store that aren't shown on the online catalog.
And then we hear stories about the people who make the things. Do the people who make the things hear stories about the people who buy the things?
Yes. We, on a regular basis, we do what they call, we have workshops where all the stores come together and they bring artisan groups in to visit with the managers, and that's where a lot of this interaction between the artisan and the store managers and the stories go back and forth about who's purchasing. And, of course, the buyers who are constantly talking to stores about what's selling and what's happening are hearing stories, and they're passing those back to the artisans as well. The artisans are always telling us, just please thank your customers for purchasing our product.
How do you find the artisans that make the product?
Well, as I said, we have buyers who are assigned regions of the world, and those buyers, they'll work with, well, they'll hear about an artisan group, or they'll be looking for a product, or because we have long-term relationships with our artisan groups, it's more likely that we have an artisan group that's going to develop a product that we're looking for than we're going to find a new artisan group that's making something. But we are constantly looking to add artisans to the mix to support their products and provide marketing for them.
Okay, well, I want to thank Noreen and Bill very much for their presentation, and we have some time. You can talk with them further, And Bill also brought a video he can turn on and show you about some of the things that are here. So thank you very much.